Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text THIN to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text THIN to 200-300. That's THIN to 200-300. THIN to 200-300.
This week on Underdogs, it's the men's tournament, and we're on to the Sweet 16. We've got a whole lot of chalk, a whole lot of offense.
And one viral tweet gone wrong.
The cry goes up both far and near for Underdog.
Underdog. Countdown going on right now. Morrow, up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes!
By George, the dream is alive.
Underdog.
And I guess there's only one thing left to do. Win the whole fucking thing.
It's the Underdogs back with you. A sweet episode as we are heading into the Sweet 16 for both the men's and women's NCAA tournaments. I am your host, Jordan Brenner, joined as always by the best co-host in the game, Peter Keating. Hello, Peter.
Hey, Jordan. How's it going? I have to say I'm a little all this chalk in the air. I'm a little, you know, it's a little dusty for me, but things are going well. How about you?
Yeah, for a couple of guys who specialize in underdogs, the men's side, we got off to a good start in the first round, but then in the second round, you're right, got very chalky. But I will say this, you've heard me say it a million times since we've even known each other. The best tournaments are exactly like this one, where you get a few first round upsets, sort of whet the appetite, captivate you, excite you. The second round gives you a lot of near upsets with exciting games. We didn't fully get that, but the Texas A&M Houston game was close. And then what you want is a largely chalky Sweet 16 because the matchups are delicious and it basically guarantees that you've got good teams going forward. Because honestly, it's a great story when you end up with San Diego State and Florida Atlantic in the Final Four, but it's just not as intriguing as a bunch of the big boys. So I'm very excited about this men's tournament and the women's tournament.
We disagree a little bit about that every year because every year I get so revved up for these underdogs. And when they lose, I'm like, oh, what am I supposed to like turn around and like really be psyched about the intricacies of like Iowa State's offense? Like, I don't even know, like half the time, I don't even know who's playing in the Elite Eight. I think you're right when it's San Diego State versus Florida Atlantic and they're underdogs we didn't love. But if you remember when Butler and VCU were in the Final Four, I mean, VCU was our model's favorite team ever. We were kind of excited then, you know?
Yeah, but it's been like, Peter, they're like kids in high school who were born, you know, during that March Madness run. So times are changing.
We'll talk about Marquette because they brought Shaka Smart on TV to say this is his first time in the Sweet 16 since that year. And I was like, first of all, it's been that long. And second of all, Shaka doesn't look as much older as I do, but he looks a little older.
So before we move on to sort of look at the Sweet 16 matchups, I want on the men's side, and then if you're listening on the podcast, we're going to do the women's side as well there. But let's talk first. If you're totally unfamiliar with what we do, we have our slingshot model. We write about it at The Athletic. We talked about it here. We project upsets where there's at least a 5 seed difference. So in the first round, I think 3 of our top 5 upsets on the board hit. The big one that didn't was New Mexico against Clemson. But what's interesting about this, Peter, and it's something we talk about and we can share with the audience, is that line had moved to the point where New Mexico entered the game as the favorite. And even though we gave them about a 57% chance to win, that was very much in line with the market. More people were taking New Mexico over Clemson. Again, the books had them favored. So in terms of leverage, it didn't really do much for you, you know, to pick them in the first place.
When we started doing this, there was no such thing as somebody saying, if this team, when we pick an underdog, right? No such thing as somebody writing in or calling in to say, would this really be an upset, right? Because they were all upsets because what we're doing was picking against bracket odds, right? And if an 11 beat a 6, it was an upset. Last year, with the spread of legalized sports betting and just the spread of information in general, right? We really started to notice that almost as soon as we could pick what you and I might call obvious underdogs, like good teams that were just really grossly misseeded, as soon as we could get the word out that these teams were in the wrong spot in the bracket, betting lines were already moving toward them, sometimes in their favor outright, sometimes including with New Mexico and Clemson, to the point where we could no longer say this team that looked like a terrific underdog because of its seeding was even a good value to bet anymore. You know, that's what happened with New Mexico.
Right. It's real. So, and what's funny is New Mexico, again, our top most likely upset, was the only one of the 4-11 seeds that didn't win. Otherwise, you had Oregon, you had Duquesne, and Peter, who am I forgetting?
NC State.
NC State, of course.
Who's still alive. Yeah.
The only one.
I mean, Jordan, you have everyone listening, everyone who ever reads this has to get that when we say there's a good chance of an underdog winning, it's not like picking UConn. It's like picking a team. No, seriously, the team has a 30, if we're really lucky, 40 or 45% chance of winning. Combine that, right, with the fact that stuff happens. You have to understand, when we say it's a really good underdog chance of winning, at best we're talking 50-50. And then there's a whole landscape of upsets that are essentially accidents. We wouldn't want them to go away, right? The charm of this event is that no matter how hard anyone works, including us full-time for months and months, right, you can't make it completely predictable. So when we're right about a trend, it's interesting. Like we don't like what we call schoolyard bullies, right? Teams that dominate inferior conferences, have a hard time turning around and beating better teams. And we saw that again this year with Vermont, right? Crushed by Duke. But guess who popped up as an underdog? Yale. You have to say sometimes stuff just happens. There's unexplainable upsets. Like Fairleigh Dickinson last year, Yale this year.
So let's talk about that one for a second. That was the one our model got most wrong. And then I want to talk about the one we got most right. So That was rough because, again, we've been talking about for a few weeks. Again, my wife demands accountability on the show, so we're going to be accountable. We've been talking for weeks about how Yale wasn't even the best killer in the Ivy League. That was Cornell or Princeton, that Yale played a much safer, less risk-seeking game. Just they didn't have a lot of statistical commonalities with typical underdogs we've seen. And by contrast, Auburn, and this is not just in our model, Ken Palm, lots of places, had them as not just a top 10 team, but often a top 5 team, great on both offense and defense. I don't know how to put it any other way other than you can predict all you want, and you can give a team a 5% chance of winning, which we did. Sometimes the 5% chance happens, and a team just shits the bed. And that's, I think, what happened with Auburn, right?
Yale, something like the 90th best team in the country. Auburn, top 5, according to analytics models. There usually is no way a matchup can counteract that gap, right? The bigger, stronger, faster team comes out and blows the inferior team off the court, despite whatever intelligence, granting, I guess, that Yale has some intelligence, or stylistic shrewdness the underdog has, usually not enough to overcome the gap. But retrospectively, you can say that anytime a team keeps things very slow and anytime an overdog starts to play terribly, the little guy's got a chance. It happened with FDU last year and it happened with Yale this year. Auburn went 7 of 20 on threes against Yale. The 20 is too low. The 7's way too low. They didn't shoot particularly well from anywhere.
They shot 51% from the field. If I told you Auburn shot 51% from the field, you would have thought they beat Yale in a cakewalk.
But they had 14 turnovers.
Well, so that's what I want to get. So weird things can happen in a one-game setting, right? And two weird things happen. First of all, 3 minutes into the game, Chad Baker Mazzara gets tossed. Yeah. Look, should Auburn be able to beat Yale most nights without him? Yes. But that makes a difference. It throws off your continuity. It's an important defensive player for them, et cetera, et cetera. The second is the 14 turnovers, which I can't explain because they were not a high turnover team all season.
Yale didn't force turnovers. I was watching that game. It's kind of driving me crazy because you may remember I picked Auburn as my outside the top 3 pick to win the national championship.
I do recall that.
Yeah.
All right. So weird things happen, but I want to talk about a weird thing that happened in our favor. And then offer a defense of John Calipari, which you would not expect from me.
Oh, my goodness. We're the underdogs, Jordan. We're the underdogs.
Okay. So if you've been asleep for the past 2 weeks, you may have missed the fact that Oakland is a 14 seed, beat Kentucky as a 3. What's cool about this is, and we were really shocked when we saw it for the first time, this game started popping in our model, and we had to do like a second and third look. We gave it about a 19 or 20% chance of occurring. The money line only implied about a 12% chance. So we said, look, this, if you're going to take a shot in a bracket pool, if you're going to take a shot on a long shot bet, which I actually did, there's leverage here. And obviously we know it worked out. You know, when you've got a 47-year-old, you know, guy with a receding hairline hitting, you know, 10 threes off screen. I don't even know what was happening there with Gaulke. You know, Townsend, we knew, is a very good player.
I'm trying to think of who Gaulke's hairline reminds me of.
Jay Billis said it was Dan Aykroyd's character in Tommy Boy.
That's pretty good. Yeah. I kept thinking of Dracula, actually. But that's the only thing I could come up with. But yeah, Tommy Boy's pretty good.
Right. And then again, it's just a situation. Look, Kentucky had its issues, but our model, and we talked about this going in, said Kentucky was overseeded as a 3 seed, that we only thought they were the 19th best team in the country, that there were 4 seeds, namely Auburn and Duke in particular, that deserved a 3 seed over them. So just from the start, Kentucky was probably a little bit overrated. But I want to, you know, sorry, let me stop and say, is there anything you learned from that Oakland upset that we can apply going forward?
Okay, yeah, people might be saying, you know, what are you so excited about this for? You guys gave it a 20% chance of happening. It happened. You just said stuff happens. This game is actually fascinating to me for two big reasons. One is, like you just mentioned with Gaulke, this game, the way this game went was enough to make me reconsider my opinion until now, backed by the data that I've seen, that experience by itself doesn't really, or time with a team by itself doesn't really matter. Every year you have guys, pundits and analysts saying, look at this freshman point guard. He's so great. You know, he brings so much energy. Then they turn around with another matchup. They say, look at these guys. They've been together 5 years. They're experienced guys. And it's half, six in one hand, half a dozen in the other. But Jordan, we've seen it a couple of times now. St. Peter's, there's other kind of deep underdogs coming out of nowhere examples. Maybe for a small program squad, that continuity, that minutes of experience together matters. And of course, in this matchup, they're facing the archetype of the one and done model, so much so that people in Kentucky are now asking, has John Palicari too, and his cousin John Calipari, the coach, have they ruined the sport of basketball for Kentucky with the, you know, they might want him out because they're the other extreme. So one thing I think we actually have to reevaluate maybe because of this game is, what is the role of that togetherness, the experience, the extra year, the COVID year, all this stuff coming together for one team being completely absent for the overdog?
So I have a lot to say on the subject, and it's also going to have to lead us into a discussion of the tweet. But first, what I want to say is, I think there are some signals that maybe there's something going on with experience, but I want to caution everyone from jumping to conclusions. We've tried to study this. The data just isn't, there's not enough of a sample size yet post-COVID to draw like true determinations, but age is one thing, experience is another thing. Okay. Mm-hmm. So yes, and we're writing an article about this right now. It's going to be out at The Athletic. You should read it. It's going to be good. Teams are older right now for two reasons. One, the COVID year basically gave kids an extra year of eligibility, which is how you have Cormac Ryan somehow still playing college basketball for North Carolina. Okay. Secondly, NIL is creating more incentive for older players to stay in college because in some cases they can make a couple $100,000 rather than going, if they're not much of an NBA prospect, going and trying to play in the G League for less money or Europe or something like that. So the game has gotten older. However, the game has also become less connected. There's less continuity because of the transfer portal. Because guys no longer have to sit out a year, there's annual free agency. And the roster turnover on most teams is shocking. You're turning over 70, 80% of your roster in a lot of cases. So what's happening, and I've been talking to a couple of coaches about this. This is my theory. Again, we'll be writing about it. Scoring is up right now in college basketball. And what you're seeing is this. Most coaches will tell you that it is much harder to teach defense than offense. It takes longer, It's not just about teaching a system, but it's players getting comfortable with one another and knowing where they are and help schemes and relating to one another and so forth. So what you have, whereas a lot of these teams are running similar offenses, it's a lot of ball screen stuff, a lot of dribble handoffs, NBA pace and space. So what you have is experienced, developed offensive players who are just better shooters at 22 than they were at 19, understand pick and rolls more than they did at 19, transferring in, not having the defensive continuity. So they're still being forced to try to gel together, but the offense is way ahead of the defense right now. And so that's what you're seeing in these games. That's how Texas A&M scores 58 points in a first half. That's why scoring is up all over the country. Coaches are agreeing with this premise. And I think you're seeing that when you take it back to Kentucky, where you really saw the issues for them all season was on defense. Mm-hmm. And they had some experienced players, but they didn't have a lot of guys who played together.
So it's fascinating you say that, because I said there were two big things about this game that fascinated me. Mm-hmm. One was the experience factor. The other one, which you've now connected to this, is that Kentucky was one of the teams with the among the upper seeds with the most pronounced split between their offense on ranking and defense. They were not a top 100 team in defense. I wondered, should you even qualify to be a 3 seed if you're not a top 100 team in defense? Everything we're saying would look a little better for Kentucky, make more sense if they had been a 4, 5, or 6 seed. So these are big changes in the game. I think we should take a break, though, and explore them when we come back.
Underdog, underdog. Underdog, underdog.
We're back. And before we get into Peter's point about offense versus defense and what that means going forward in the Sweet 16, I just want to take a moment to think the right word is kvetch about a tweet I sent late last week that kind of went viral, but was really misinterpreted by a lot of the not smartest people in the world. So,
oh, Jordan, people disagree with you. Suddenly you call them morons.
Yeah,
is
that's
that how
what
it's
we're
gonna
doing
go?
Here. Yeah, that's how it's going to go.
Okay? I think that's unfortunate.
I pointed out that the University of North Carolina, a fine institution of higher learning, has a starting five whose age is almost identical to that of the Oklahoma City Thunder, a professional basketball team that is currently winning the Western Conference.
Seems harmless enough to me, Jordan.
It's remarkable.
It's just some numbers.
Lou Dort of the Thunder, who I believe has been guarding other NBA teams' top perimeter players since Dominique Wilkins was in the league, is still only 24, whereas Cormac Ryan of the Tar Heels will turn 26 later this calendar year. But my point, I had a couple points. First of all, the main point is, holy cow, that's amazing what the Thunder are doing to be that good with that lineup that's basically the same age as a college team. The second point is, I do think the college game has gotten too old. I don't think 25 and 26-year-olds should be playing college basketball. But nowhere did I say that North Carolina has done anything wrong by playing by the rules, or that Cormac Ryan has done anything wrong by getting another free year of education. If this is the system, that's fine.
How do you get to be 26 and still playing in the NCAA? Is he pursuing a PhD in medieval studies? Like, what's the longest amount of time you can take to maintain your eligibility?
Seriously. This is his third school. He also, by the way, I think he prepped a year out of high school, then he went to Stanford, then he played 3 years at Notre Dame. Now he's
hang on, back up a minute. What does it matter that it's his third year? Has he been sitting out from year to year?
The COVID year gave everybody a fifth year to play.
Okay, so let's be fair about this, which is that athletes got that extra year of eligibility because a bunch of them had to spend a year in quarantine. I mean, I personally think that's an okay thing, and the effects of it will literally fade over time, right?
Let's see what happens. Yes, this will shrink. It should take a year off these numbers, but you'd still have Cormac Ryan at 24 playing. Anyway, my point was, it was not meant to criticize him or his lovely program. I do think there needs to be some thoughts about whether we want 18, 19-year-olds playing against grown men and what that means in terms of the development and what college basketball is about. But that's for another show where I reinvent the whole game. Peter, in the meantime, Yahoo stole my tweet, passed it off as their own, made a graphic. I hope our producer, Sarah, shows that on the DraftKings Network broadcast. How dare you, Yahoo?
So whatever you think of Jordan's opinion, first of all, I mean, cut it out with the aggregators just copying stuff. That's ridiculous. Give some credit where credit is due. Second of all, look, this shows what you're talking about, what you're talking about in terms of when the game, college game, ages and when there are players transferring and with extra years of eligibility. What this is doing is it's accentuating the split between offense and defense among the very best teams, right, Jordan? Among the top teams, there were way more teams, top-seeded teams. There were way more teams with, you know, big, high rankings in offense who are meh or worse in defense than we have seen before. I think it's because, like you're saying, it's easier to assemble offenses on the fly than defensive cohesiveness.
And that's what makes one matchup in particular in the Sweet 16 so interesting. Yeah. You've got the number one offense in the country, Illinois. They're 92nd in defense, according to KenPom.com, against Iowa State, which has the number one defense in the country and ranks 49th in offense. So just the classic irresistible force, immovable object game. And it's largely a toss-up. How excited are you for this one, Peter? And do you have any insight into who's going to win?
I'm super excited because we often say in studying underdogs, oh, they grow up so fast. Sometimes underdogs are just small programs that maintain excellence in their niche forever. But often they're good underdogs on their way from being bad teams to good teams, right? Because in that middle stage, you can still be an underdog, but you still can be pretty good and scare better teams. We caught Iowa State like that 2 years ago, right? When they're on their way from, bottoming out to where few programs had been before, going 2-22. And now they're one of the five or 10 or four or five best teams in the country. Right when they were on the ascent, we caught them as a fun underdog. What they've kept since then is this uncanny ability to turn the other teams, to turn the ball over for the other team. I mean, force other teams into mistakes. And I think that's the key in this matchup. You can be as good an offensive as you want, but when you get disrupted in ways that you don't understand, we find those teams often don't do as well as we think they will in matchups against great defenses.
You said it. This is the most interesting piece of this game is the turnover battle. Iowa State, second in the country, forcing turnovers. Illinois, third worst in the country in forcing turnovers. So, Illinois, good guards, good handle. Will they be able to handle Iowa State's pressure and not give them extra possessions? If so, I think Illinois wins. But if they get taken out of their rhythm offensively, if they do turn the ball over, they're not going to get it back at the other end. That would be the difference for Iowa State.
Right. Peter. And this is like, look, in statistical terms, like if I say to you, here's a batter in baseball who's hitting 320. Here's a pitcher who's giving up a batting average of 320. What do you think that batter will hit against that pitcher? Instinctively, you might say he'll hit 320, but no. If one team is way better than average and the other team is way worse than average at the same thing they're matching up on, you're going to get an extreme result. I think that ball is going to be flying all over the place. I don't think Illinois is going to be able to keep their hands.
But Illinois doesn't turn it over a lot themselves. So it's really much more about, can they, you know, again, how will they handle it? Because they're not going to turn Iowa State over.
Right.
It's just a question of, can they handle Iowa State's pressure? And that remains to be seen. Peter, there, we have one game that that counts as a bracket breakers game. It's 11th seeded NC State against 2nd seeded Marquette. It's the only one that our model is applicable for. And we've been on NC State for a while, and we've been warning you about Marquette for a while, and they almost lost to Colorado. So are there some warning signs going off here?
Look, Marquette almost didn't make it past Western Kentucky, right? They beat Colorado by an unimpressive 4 points. They just don't hit the boards at either end. Now, as we was just praising Shaka Smart before, he's put together another great team, a team that does turn opponents over, but there are big warning signs about how they could be vulnerable. NC State, look, we have not found that recent performance matters all that much, but in cases where there's kind of what you have to say, a fundamentally different team playing, it might matter more than our statistical model thinks. For example, like if Kolek was out for Marquette, we'd say, well, that makes a big difference, right? Well, look, when Burns had a double-double in the last NC State game, and they said, that's his second double-double of the season. I was like, wait, what? I thought from watching NC State in the tournament, he had like 20 double-doubles. I'm exaggerating, but yeah, I thought he was a double-double some season. But no, the offense didn't go flow through this guy who's been unstoppable all year the way it has in the past three or four games. NC State's doing a better job getting the ball inside to him and doing a better job shutting down opponents on the perimeter. I think they're a few points stronger than everyone thinks. So look, our model likes NC State a little bit better than the historical average. Usually 11 seeds win only 16% of the time against two seeds. Our model thinks there's about a 22% chance of this happening. But Jordan, to go on the other hand, betting markets already making NC State, giving NC State implied odds of 30% of winning this game. So
sure.
Is there value there? No, but NC State's a dangerous underdog. That's what I'm seeing.
Well, speaking of dangerous underdogs, real quick before we have to go, I'm looking again, a very chalky bracket where it's, you know, ones and twos and a lot of threes. Is there anyone standing out sort of under the radar who might be able to make a Final Four run? I'm eyeing Gonzaga, who looked really good in both their first two games. And we know Purdue is just waiting to collapse. You know, I think that could be an upset we see in the Sweet 16. Anything else standing out to you?
Absolutely, Gonzaga. They've been playing at a very high level all year. The only reason they're outside the top three seeds is because they were underseeded. I like Houston to win it all. I have all year.
Wow, if real underdog there, PK.
Well, you know, everyone loves UConn so much that I'm going to call anyone other than UConn an underdog, number one. Okay. And number two, if you didn't collapse after what Texas A&M did to Houston, you can stand in there and beat anybody. There's a completely non-statistical take, but that was an impressive gutty overtime.
Right,
they had no players left.
And let me just say before I tease our Instagram, as our producer Sarah would like us to do, the Duke-Houston game should be fascinating. I want you to pay attention to how tightly the game is called. Houston is physical and strong, but you saw against Texas A&M when they're officiated for that, they had four guys foul out. Houston's going to try to punk Duke on the perimeter. Duke has young perimeter players other than Jeremy Roach. They're not as physically strong. If they call fouls, Duke has a great chance to win this game. If they don't, it could be a Houston blowout. But that Duke is playing at a high level right now. It's just a question of the physicality of this matchup. And speaking of physicality, I'm going to get slapped across the face if I don't tell you guys to please check out our new Instagram account. It is Underdog Show. Sarah McCrory, our producer, is posting great clips there, which is hard to do when the clips come from us. So
yes,
check it out.
We have seized control of our social media and given it to our producer, Sarah, who's doing a hell of a job. Yeah. If you don't like us, reward her, please.
Yeah, so check
us out on
out.
Instagram.